Here comes Uncle Don with the 317th opening of the Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. There's a great public outrage at multimillion-dollar bonuses thrown to executives of companies receiving vast public bailouts. Top dogs of large corporations, public and private, receive a stew of so-called incentives totaling more than could be justified by any combination of talent and effort. The Globe and Mail printed a list of Canadian chief executives by rank of their total earnings, with the head of Thomson Reuters Corporation on top. Although his salary was only $1.6 million, his take-home came to over $39 million when it included his bonus, stock awards, stock options, pensions, and other items. His nominal salary was only a couple of weeks' remuneration out of the total. And what of this other category? Perhaps that covers the company limo and driver, as well as use of the corporate jet for family holidays. We just don't know. What we do know was that the lowest paid of the top 100 Canadian CEOs grossed over $800,000 on a salary of $474,000. I fail to see why it is necessary to lard a well-paid position with incentives, especially those awarded after the fact. A salary in the million-dollar range should be sufficient to entice maximum effort. The argument for bloated compensation is that rare talent, the same talent that precipitated today's meltdown, will run off to foreign shores unless lavish benefits are thrown at executives. Bullshit. Reining in should be an international project. It would have to be in conjunction with opening secret bank accounts in tax havens to official scrutiny and an international exchange of information on wealth and earnings. This should not offend the wealthy, as it is in keeping with government's total information awareness campaigns snooping into our smallest financial affairs. In a capitalist economy, a private company can give the hotshot whatever they please, and in a democratic society, the government of the day would be free to tax any benefits over and above salary at 100%. We pay lip service to the ownership economy, where everyone has a stake in international prosperity. Then we allow single entities to become too big to fail. We allow one family of billionaires, the Waltons of Arkansas, to expand around the world, exploiting their workers and driving independent retailers to the wall, while forcing manufacturers to move jobs offshore to meet the ever-increasing demand for lower prices. During this time of fiscal crisis, it would be a perfect spot to break up the monster corporations, bringing back the smaller outfits that would actually compete while providing jobs and opportunities for new enterprises. Recall that this worked a century ago when the Standard Oil Company was splintered into competing entities. Globalization could be beneficial if it did indeed provide that level playing field that corporate and political types love to trumpet. Comparative advantage is fine if it means raising global well-being and isn't built on driving down living standards to the lowest common denominator. Anyway, I've had my rant. In essence, the system is broken, as evidenced by increasing poverty amongst those who do the world's real work, while the number of billionaires grows exponentially. If we use the democracy which we hold in such high esteem, we'd be correcting this fierce imbalance by whatever means necessary. Our Canadian federal government wrings its collective hands over the terrible hole in their ability to monitor our every communication. Maybe you didn't realize this, but our police are burdened with a task of obtaining a nasty, dirty old warrant before they can legally intercept your emails or check on the websites you visit. What business is it of some dumb judge if cops want to go fishing around in your personal communications? They're the police, right? They look after our welfare while protecting us from those with impure thoughts. This lack is going to be filled if the Conservatives have their way, with new legislation allowing police and intelligence agencies to collect information on our computer usage direct from internet providers. Soon they will all be required to install equipment allowing snoops to monitor our usage without having to disturb judges, who do, after all, have more important work to attend to, like sending kids to prison for drug use. As a sweetener, this legislation will allow authorities to track the whereabouts of persons of interest through their cell phones and in-car devices. We have yet to be required to carry cell phones for this purpose, but this lies in the future. Two bills have been introduced in Parliament that George L. Orwell would have appreciated. They are the Investigative Powers for the 21st Century Act and the Technical Assistance for Law Enforcement in the 21st Century Act. Wow. Peter Van Loan, our Orwellian named Minister for Public Safety, said, "We must provide our law enforcement with the tools they need to keep our communities safe. This is a great day for victims and their families who have long been calling for these legislative changes, and those who work tirelessly every day to ensure that when there's a threat to safety, police can intervene quickly." Bullshit. Look at the way authorities can already monitor us with or without legal niceties. Our telephone and mail can be intercepted. Our book purchases and borrowings from libraries are recorded. By the use of credit cards, debit cards, and affinity cards, our buying habits are known. They know where we holiday and when we travel overseas. They have access to our banking and employment records. They know where we live, whether we own, and if we have mortgages. They know who our friends are and what organizations we join or support. With automated license plate readers, they can track our movements. They monitor our electricity usage in order to spot changes that might, or might not, indicate a bit of basement farming, so that they can use that as an excuse to kick in your door. There's damn little privacy left from those who choose to snoop in the internet. One of the last bastions of individual freedom is a target for these ultimate controllers. We should be very careful of powers we give to those who claim to be acting to protect us. They're human and possess human failings. As Benjamin Franklin said, those who trade freedom for security deserve neither. 50 kilometers north of Prince George lies Summit Lake, a sprawling body of water feeding both the Pacific and Arctic Oceans. On its shore stands a forestry campsite bearing signs declaring it to be a user-maintained facility and asking the public to clean up after themselves when using it. The place has a boat launch and many campsites with fireplaces and picnic tables. I had not visited the Summit Lake for a couple of years, so it was with high hopes that my wife and I loaded the dogs in our truck and drove up there last week. When we arrived, we found entrances barred and deep ditches all around prohibiting access. I was angry that this beautiful area had been closed to us. We parked outside the barrier and walked in, soon discovering why it had been denied to the public. The first thing we noticed was the litter everywhere. Then we came to the campsites. Marker signs were flattened. Picnic tables, both concrete and wooden, were destroyed. Fire pits, when not rolled into the lake, were filled with garbage. Outhouses had their doors torn from hinges. In some, vandals had destroyed the facilities. We were disgusted. What the hell is wrong with our people that they would take advantage of an area built at public expense and leave it such a ruin that its pleasures would be denied to others? Joe Clark is underrated as a former Canadian Prime Minister. He was defeated after a short reign, not because of his policies and performance, but based largely on a film clip showing him stumbling on the steps of an airplane. Who among the great unwashed wants a klutz for Prime Minister? Such is the power of image over reason in elections these days. Joe had a dedication to Canada conspicuous by its absence in recent regimes. He was arguably the last of the progressive conservatives. Stephen Harper and his accomplice Peter MacKay did a good job of scouring any vestige of progressivism from the right-wing alliance now known as merely conservative. Joe was only 39 when PM, so he's still relatively young and certainly not silent. Whether he was really clumsy is a moot point. He was and is one smart fella. He's been speaking out on the issue of increased regulations proposed to force honesty and accountability in the corporate and political world. He told the Inquiry into Mulroney Bribes, "We have a series of rules that will catch people. The emphasis is on some kind of punishment. The consequences of straying from rules rather than the spirit that would lead one to respect the rules." He believes that more rules for politicians will merely discourage good people from entering public life. "We see that rules and laws don't affect the actions of those in power as much as we would like to believe. They know how to skirt, if not flout, rules. Even when caught red-handed, they resort to legalisms thrown out by batteries of sharp lawyers to evade or postpone justice." I learned this lesson while working as an assistant to a provincial government official in Prince George. An order came down from Victoria's Minister of Finance, baldly declaring that government vehicles could no longer be used for private business. He went on to clarify the point. They were not to be driven to lunches, nor could they be taken home at night, period. The intent of the order was crystal clear. When I told my boss this would create quite a stir, his reply was, "We'll have to interpret it." What was to interpret? Did he want the order in French? The upshot was that nothing changed. Government cars still went home with big shots. The interpretation there was that the region lacked an adequate overnight security and plug-ins for winter. There was always some official errand that needed to be performed on the way to lunch. This was not my first lesson. That was when I was interviewed for a job with the Unemployment Commission in town. At that time, there was a mandated hiring freeze for federal employees, so during my interview, I asked how I could be hired during a supposed freeze. The woman who was to become my boss replied, "We're a long way from Ottawa." In the case of cars, a reasonable rule was circumvented for the convenience of employees. In the UIC case, the order was ignored for the simple reason that the job was vacant while its necessary functions remained. So we have two classes of rule circumventions. While bosses often look to their own perquisites, those at the bottom may evade rules, as following orders makes their jobs impossible. The answer to clearing the deck for efficiency and honesty is not more regulation, according to Joe Clark. What is needed is a restoration of ethical behavior. In the Reagan-Thatcher era of private greed and public deterioration, it was put succinctly by Maggie, who famously said, "There is no such thing as society." If society does not exist, just a mob of competing individuals, there's nothing wrong with the trashing of the Summit Lake campsite. After all, it belonged to everyone, and therefore to no one. Joe Clark was right on the mark when he said, "We need a return to the ethics of service in both public and private sphere." The executive of a corporation should be serving his or her stakeholders, as they are called. Their legal obligation at present is merely to delivering profit to those owning company stock, a goal that ignores others to whom the corporation is vital. This goal gives subtle sanction to tax chiseling, exploiting employees, ravishing the environment, and destroying communities while producing the cheapest products and services at the highest prices the market will bear. The prime example can be seen in the Mallwart chain, which has built fortunes for its owners while leaving behind a trail of social destruction. We need to rescue our democracy from those who serve themselves and their social class at the expense of the rest of us. Brian Mulroney is a fine sampling of this type of politician. Behind a facade of public service, he sold us out to his American friends with the free trade agreement. He used his position as PM to promote the purchase of Airbuses for Air Canada, still a public enterprise before it was given to speculators. It hasn't been proven in court, but we have serious suspicions that a subsequent gift of hundreds of thousands in cash was his reward for a betrayal of trust. But we needn't go into the beyond the borders of British Columbia to find political self-interest trumping public service. Gordon Campbell sold our railway. The public's reward for this betrayal of a solemn campaign promise was a lot less than the purported billion-dollar price. The trial of two men who allegedly benefited from interference on behalf of CN, the buyer, has dragged on for years. The defendants say they're acting for the man at the top, you know who, but the trail of evidence has been obliterated by the destruction of emails from that period. Funny thing is, such destruction is patently illegal, but Campbell's government seems to be unable to locate the culprit. The democratic process has failed to bring British Columbia a government responsible to all stakeholders, a term I dislike, except the wealthy insiders Campbell represents. Opposition is pathetic and misguided. The working class is deluded by slick propaganda. The ravished environment suffering from open-net fish farms, private exploitation of rivers, and free-range mining has no vote. The public's being saddled with huge debts, but remains oblivious. Is there opportunity for election of Canadian politicians dedicated to public service? I doubt it, as long as the electorate can be snowed by slick attack ads and propaganda while attention is diverted to ongoing tasks of making a living and rearing a family. We're flooded with expensive advertising financed by corporations. Political parties don't reveal their policies in any but the most general terms out of fear of alienating one segment or another of voters. Even when they espouse firm policies, once in office they betray them with impunity. Recall Mulroney's statements that free trade would not come about on his watch and Campbell's pledge not to sell BC Rail. Such betrayals carry no penalties any more than destroying evidence or taking cash bribes in their execution. So Joe Clark is right in that we need a return to ethics in business and public service. A return, that is, if it ever really existed in the past. Depends on whose history you read. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Here in British Columbia, ethics is an alien concept. Gordon Campbell has what is called a special relationship with Ottawa's Harper regime. They share the same goals and methods. May the gods help us all. For instance, during our last provincial election, the incumbent claimed that he would under no circumstances allow our provincial deficit to exceed $495 million. This was rock solid. Well, there's rocks in the ground and there's rocks in our heads if we believe any two words put together during a campaign. Gordon Campbell knew flat out that his deficit figure was fantasy, but his flunkies managed to cover up relevant figures until after his crew was safely reelected. Emails have come to light revealing that the government had an update on ballooning welfare costs a month before the election, an update that said the number of recipients and the total expense was well beyond estimates. Then the Public Affairs Bureau stepped in to quash the news. A government communications officer sent an email to the analyst reading, "Hi, John. Can we please hold off on posting these updates until after the election? Thanks for your help." Was the electorate not entitled to this timely news? Might it have cost the Liberals some seats if we knew that Campbell's figures were deliberately fudged? Where was the NDP at this time? I'd hoped that they had the resources and connections to figure the Premier was blowing smoke, if not deliberately lying. No, they were running around screaming, "Axe the tax!" Humbug. Meanwhile, the NDP was also failing to exploit Campbell's major betrayals in giving away our railway and our rivers. Thus is politics in British Columbia functioning. I'm amused at the indignation expressed at China's efforts to corner supplies of materials vital to its economy. Thanks to North America's willingness to go deeply into debt with China financing our profligate lifestyle, that nation now sits on trillions of dollars in reserves while we're weighted with debt and the interest payments thereon. Our governments assumed that China would sit on our debt, content to collect interest in perpetuity. What a shock to find they're using the funds to buy access to resources. They're closing deals in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, trading Chinese-paid infrastructure development and loans for future delivery of raw materials. The indebted world is incensed. With markets deprived of the metals, foods, and most importantly, oil cornered by China, prices in the remaining free markets will rise. As our industries suffer higher costs for inputs, China will have locked-in supplies so they can continue to undercut world prices with their exports. Before we let ourselves choke up over the perceived injustice of such cornering of resources, let's look at where they got the idea. Capitalist steel corporations seek to tie up supplies of iron and fluxes. Automakers contract steel supplies to the detriment of the free market. Energy companies lock in deals with oil-producing countries. Alcan secures supplies of cheap energy. We pay lip service to free markets for resources, but countenance monopolization as long as it's accomplished by our corporations. When another nation challenges our use of this tactic, it's declared to be dirty pool. China learned from us, and we have to deal with it. This trend is another indication of our empire is declining while the Chinese empire is growing. And here's another bitch we have with China. They're limiting exports. What? I thought they were flooding North America with their products, causing a massive trade deficit. The U.S. and Europe complain that China has placed export controls on raw materials and components like aluminum, steel, solar cells, pharmaceuticals, and microchips. When they sell such items to us at less than domestic producers, they're accused of dumping. When they forbid our industries from importing cheaper materials, they're charged with limiting free trade. We certainly seem to want it both ways, but I suspect that all this fuss is a smokescreen behind which we hide the failings of our system while denying the successes of theirs. I hear that the Catholic Church is considering the canonization of Michael Jackson. They have an opening for a patron saint of child molesters. American politicians can criticize the failings of Canada's socialized medicine, but they have no right to distort statistics in support of their arguments. A Canadian senator, a Tory no less, has charged a Republican U.S. senator from Kentucky of using phony figures when comparing wait times at Kingston General Hospital with those of American hospitals. The worthy Kentuckian, undoubtedly a colonel in the Confederate Army, inflated Canadian wait times in every category he quoted. One comparison that the colonel did did not emphasize his life expectancy in Kentucky versus Ontario. Kentucky residents can expect to live 75.2 years. Ontarians average 80.4 years. The kicker was the reply from the American. He said that Kentuckians actually had a greater life expectancy if murder rates are excluded. Which brings forth the question of gun control, a subject that Americans, right-wingers, won't touch with a barge pole. Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms contains many of the same guarantees as the American Bill of Rights. We not only share those rights, but the loopholes allowing government to violate these rights with impunity. Section 8 of our Charter reads, "Everyone has the right to be secure against unreasonable search or seizure." I suggest that unreasonable search was intended to include not just a physical frisk of your person and invasion of your property, but would include your communications. This right has been circumvented in all of its respects. With the sanction of a warrant, your mail can be opened, your home invaded, frisked and bugged, your email and internet searches monitored, and your telephone tapped. If you're accused of having contact with government-defined terrorists, you can even be incarcerated indefinitely. Canadians have too much faith in the wall of privacy surrounding us. It proves to be a tissue of protection. A loophole in Canada's criminal code allows police to tap telephones during emergencies, as defined by the police themselves. No permission is required, no records need be kept, and no one informed as to the fact that such taps have been made. This loophole, like so many others, has been abused hundreds of times, making a mockery of our protection from unwarranted, so to speak, intrusions. Allow an official even the smallest exemptions to a rule or law, and they'll drive a truck through it. The answer to supposed emergencies is to have judges available around the clock. These judges would have to look at the facts in every case to decide whether a true emergency exists. If so, a specific warrant would be issued with a specific time limit, after which a full investigation would be required and a public record made. As long as the police and security forces have extraordinary powers to intrude in our affairs, these powers will become ordinary. Violations of our rights should be included in the criminal code so that those abusing our privacy could be held accountable and subject to prosecution. Until then, our purported rights are as flimsy as the paper upon which they're written. I think I've discovered what Harper meant when he promised open and accountable government. Open means that all that we say, write, and do are open to government scrutiny. Canadians have little scope in which our private lives are inviolate. My phone can be tapped, my letters read, my mail open, or return address is noted. If I had a cell phone, my travels could be monitored by satellite. My credit card purchases can be followed, and my international comings and goings noted. Even such private affairs like television shows I might watch, if I did indeed patronize the box, and even keystrokes on my computer can be read from a distance, as can internal conversations be heard from windowpane vibrations. If I were to attain such notoriety as has Abdulrazak, I could be shadowed by unidentified plainclothes spooks, just as he is. Yes, we're all quite open, and we are accountable for our thoughts and actions. Accountable to government, which, if they wish, can dredge up arcane offenses against the Criminal Code of Canada or myriad regulations to which we're supposed to adhere every moment of our lives. We can be held accountable to the courts, dragging us through endless procedures until our strength and finances are exhausted. Witness the Kafkaesque ordeal through which Abdulrazak was subjected. Ah, yes, the third leg of that open, accountable government. Government. They are the government, and they do what they do is none of our business. What they cannot hide, they lie about. Their promises are meaningless, and their supposed reports are spun with an eye to influencing the next election instead of revealing any truths. We are open and accountable. Government is not. Am I being unfair in my assessment of Stephen Harper and regime? I don't think so. For instance, Harper promised his government would create an Office of Parliamentary Budget Officer, which would report on the state of the nation's finances and trends in the national economy, directly to the House of Commons and the public. Yes, the office was created, and a well-qualified gentleman, Kevin Page, was given the title. But from the get-go, he was assigned an office in the Parliamentary Library, an inauspicious beginning. Since the creation of that office, he's come up with accurate reports that put the lie to government-announced figures. He reported the cost of our Afghan adventure when Harper was lowballing it by more than half. He warned of larger deficits than those predicted by our Minister of Finance, and he was right. As a reward for his efficiency, Kevin has been muzzled. No longer will he report openly to Parliament and the public. By a joint Commons Senate committee order, his research findings will be secret until such time, if ever, the confidentiality is lifted. The interpretation of that is we will hear nothing from Mr. Page until his results fall in line with the political aims of the party in power. And we can expect this gag order to be maintained whether liberals or conservatives hold the reins of government. It's altogether a goddamn shame that this nation's citizens have discarded the opportunity afforded us by our ancestors, our Constitution, and our Charter of Rights and Freedoms. We've allowed ourselves to be lured by fleeting entertainment distractions of sport and television while wallowing in mindless accumulation of ever bigger vehicles, homes, and assorted junk to fill them, as successive governments have tightened the noose of propaganda and control over our lives and futures for the benefit of their class, its corporations, and their foreign allies. But hey, don't worry. Be happy. Uncle Don carries on and has yet to be assassinated. It pleases me. This concludes the 317th edition of My Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Vladimir Lenin said, "Why should freedom of speech and freedom of the press be allowed? Why should a government which is doing what it believes to be right allow itself to be criticized? It would not allow opposition by lethal weapons. Ideas are much more fatal things than guns."